Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Michael Hawkins, Associate Professor of Asian History and Associate Chairman in the Department of History at Creighton, as well as author of Making Moros, Imperial Historicism, and American Military Rule in the Philippines' Muslim South. Dr. Hawkins will speak on the topic American Colonization of Muslims in the Southern Philippines. His remarks were given as the faculty lecture, part of the 11th Annual Asian Culture Week, presented by Creighton's Asian World Center. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 28, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Maurang Jang, the director of the Asian World Center at Creighton University.
I would like to say a few words about the Asian World Center. The Asian World Center has hosted lectures, workshops, art exhibitions, concerts, and residency programs that have attracted an estimated 5,000 participants from across the heartland of America. More than 100 leading scholars, artists, scientists, policymakers, business leaders, and diplomats have shared their insights and experiences with Creighton's campus and around the Omaha community since the center was established in 2006. This year, we celebrate the 11th Annual Asian Culture Week. This year's event is co-sponsored by the John C. Kanefick Faculty Chair in the Humanities. And the holder of that chair is Dr. Patrick Murray. Tonight, we are very honored that we will have Dr. Michael Hawkins to present the 2015 Creighton Asian World Center Faculty Lecture Series. His topic is American Colonization of Muslims in the Southern Philippines. Dr. Michael Hawkins is an Associate Professor of Asian History and Associate Chair in the Department of History at Creighton University. His research interests revolve around empire, Islam, and agency in Asia, with a particular interest in notions of historical time. Michael is a former Fulbright Fellow to the Philippines, where he had lived for many years. Michael is the author of Making Moros, Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in the Philippines' Muslim South. The book was published in 2013, as well as a number of articles on the above subjects. Dr. Michael Hawkins received his PhD in history from Northern Illinois University. He received his MA from Boise State University and his bachelor degree from Brigham Young University. I would like to thank you for coming tonight to attend this lecture, and please now join me in welcoming Dr. Hawkins for his great presentation.
All right, well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I'd first like to thank the Asian World Center, and especially to thank Maurang. We've had such a great opportunity to work together since I've arrived at Creighton, and he's been a real guide through the institution, and we've spent time in Asia together, and I'm happy to be here. So as he said, tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the American colonization of Muslims in the Southern Philippines, and as a particular subset of that, I want to talk about this weird intersection in which American military officials in the Southern Philippines were interested in preserving savagery and domesticating violence, which seems sort of antithetical to the colonial project in general. But the American military has a very funny relationship with the Muslims. So for a bit of history, the Americans acquired the Philippines in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. And they displaced over 300 years of Spanish colonialism. And there were two areas of the Philippines that the Spanish were never quite able to conquer. They were unable to conquer highland tribes in the northern parts of Luzon, known as the Igorots or the Ifugao or the Iboloy, a number of what we consider to be sort of these highland hunter-gatherer societies. And the Spanish were never quite able to conquer Muslim tribes in the south. They were largely located on the eastern part, or I'm sorry, in the western part of Mindanao and the Sulu Archipelago. Now, when they got to the Philippines, the Americans bifurcated the population into two overarching groups. On the one hand, you had the civilized, which were considered to be lowland Christianized Filipinos that had largely been Hispanized and adopted the culture of the Spanish. And then you had the wild people, which were the highlanders of Luzon and some highlanders in Mindanao, and of course the Muslim tribes. Now, while they immediately began to implement civilian government among the lowland populations, the military was charged with ruling over the wild peoples. And so in 1899, the U.S. military forged an agreement with the Sultan of Sulu that was known as the Bates Treaty. And the Bates Treaty was essentially an agreement of non-interference. They didn't want the Muslims getting involved in the Philippine-American War and the insurgency, and so they said, if you will just cede to our overarching authority, we will leave you alone. We won't mess with polygamy. We won't mess with slavery. We won't mess with Islam. We will basically keep a sort of hands-off approach to the southern Philippines while we get this worked out. And so the military began to occupy parts of Mindanao and Sulu, but they did so in a way that was kind of in accommodation to the Moros, or to the Filipinos in the south, the Muslims. Soon, however, this became untenable. Americans simply could not abide a colonial possession in which they found evils such as polygamy, such as slavery, such as some of the practices that the Muslims had. And so by 1903, the military feels it necessary to abrogate the treaty, which they do in 1903. And instead, they implement a full military control and government over the southern Philippines that becomes known as Moro Province. Now, Moro Province is really something distinct from the colony. So when we say American colonialism in the Philippines, we think about school teachers and health officials and nurses and doctors going over to make the world a better place. And that's true for a good majority of the colony. But in the South, we have what really amounts to a completely separate colonial entity. And it's much different than the civilian government throughout most of the islands. The military employs a very strict, authoritarian, concise, very efficiently run regime in the South. And in some ways, this is a big advantage. The military officials believe that they have an opportunity for a pure American colonial experience, one that's unencumbered by all these entanglements with politics at home and one that's entangled with all these different politics in the colony. And they feel in their progressive spirit that we can actually create modern individuals out of these Muslims. And then they got even more excited. Because as the military began to explore the various tribes in the southern Philippines, they found something that they'd been looking for quite some time. Now, at the end of the 19th century, the Americans, generally speaking, particularly bourgeois elements of the American society, were suffering from a deep and abiding psychosocial crisis. This has been well documented in the works of T.J. Jackson Lears and Hofstadter and, of course, Gail Biederman and Kristen Hoganson and people like that. But the 19th century, Americans began to experience a kind of weightlessness. Life had become strangely unreal. Industrial technology had really entrenched itself in the cities, and suddenly individuals began to feel, in some ways, alienated from any primal connection to their existence. In many of the ways that we do, right? I mean, I don't grow my own food. I don't make my own clothes. Wore my shoes. I didn't build my house. And so I'm curiously sort of detached and floating through this modern existence. Americans were also seeing the end of the frontier. Now, for the longest time, Americans believed that we are Americans because of the frontier, right? We take the people that the world didn't want and we accept them and we pour them into the crucible of the frontier, and through grit and gumption and hard work, the Americans at the time argued we make the greatest people on earth. But now the frontier is closed. In 1894, Frederick Jackson Turner gives his paper, The Frontier Thesis, and essentially he says, You know, America as we know it is over. And so Americans were searching for something. They begin to suffer from these modern psychological ailments, like neurasthenia, if you've ever heard of such a thing. Nervous prostration. They couldn't get out of bed. They couldn't face another day. They didn't know where they belonged or what their identity was. And so Americans began to seek a more primal connection to their existence. And this came about in a couple of ways. They wanted a new frontier. They were looking for this. They wanted something that embodied real life. And for many of them, what embodied real life was conflict, right? You don't get more definitive than that. Life and death. Blood, courage. They also wanted to experience, at least vicariously, a pre-industrial life. And so many of these bourgeois progressives on the East Coast are going out into the slums, into the rural areas, and they're trying to seek real experience. And they do this mostly through trying to uplift those that are experiencing pre-industrial life to live a kind of industrial life. And so they get very concerned with protecting animals and with reforming prisons and caring for the mentally ill and going into slums and sanitation and these kinds of things. And it's therapeutic and it helps, but they're still looking for something. Well, of course, in 1898, they got their opportunity. With the Spanish-American War, they could obtain a frontier. They could obtain pre-industrial subjects. They could go and exercise this progressive need to vicariously experience a pre-industrial life. And so when the military men got to Mindanao, when they got to Sulu, when they came among the Moros, which is what the Filipino Muslims were called, they had a moment of nostalgia. They looked at these Moros that were supposedly savage, and they sort of jealously admired them. They said, this is what we used to be. The masculinity, the courage, the grit. And so the American military men felt what we have found here is a prototypical modern man. And they began to distinguish these Moros from the Filipinos that they found in the north, which the military men considered to be effeminate, parochial, Hispanized. They were a conquered people in the north. The Spanish had thoroughly scrubbed their indigenous culture and created a defeated colonial mentality. And the Moros didn't suffer from this. The Moros were still pristine. You could still do something with them. And so the Moros, the military men immediately begin to romanticize these Muslims. Savage, defiant, exotic. There was something particularly honest and unadulterated about their exoticism that inspired Americans to vicariously recapitulate their own perceived rise to dominance within modernity. Initial reports of the Philippine Commission by the military and the census took special note of the Moros' warlike and hostile spirit. They were brave, dashing, audacious. They had the courage not to fight a guerrilla war, but, quote, they exposed themselves to an attack by modern artillery. They're easily whipped, and though the whipping may have to be repeated once or twice, its effect is ultimately salutary. They're never defeated. The Americans began to romanticize them in the same way that Western gunfighters were romanticized in dime novels. The clearest example of this, of course, is the Juramentado. The Juramentado was an early Muslim suicide attacker. They would perform various rites. They would bind their body incredibly tight in linen and shave their eyebrows and clip their fingernails, and then would go into the nearest American camp, pull out their longsword and their kris, and would try to kill as many Americans as they possibly could before being shot down. And there's a famous story. If you ever go to Mindanao, you will hear this story, which shows you how collaborative and discursive this identity formation was, that the Moros are also participating in this Orientalist definition of themselves. So if you ever go to Mindanao, here's a story they'll tell you. It's been recounted in a number of books, so I suppose it's true. But apparently, at the time of colonization, the standard issue sidearm for an American military man was a 38 caliber revolver. The problem was you could empty all six chambers on one of these juramentados, and with the tightly bound linens, the bullets would go in and the bleeding would stop and the juramentado could go on his rampage. And so the military asked for a new sidearm. They wanted a 45 caliber with the ballistic stopping power that they could use, that even though the juramentado would come, they could shoot him with the 45 and knock him down, and they could walk up and shoot him in the face or something, right? And the Americans were so impressed by this. But not only the Americans, but the Muslims as well. If you go to the southern Philippines, the Muslims will be the first to tell you that story. We were so ferocious and unstoppable that we had to have a different caliber. And so the Americans love this. They absolutely love it. They begin to romanticize mortal bodies. They talk about the well-defined calves and the shoulders and the penetrating eyes. And before long, the reports are telling us that mortals can hold their breath for 6 minutes. They can dive to depths of hundreds of feet. They can climb a tree like a squirrel. They can fall from that tree on their head and then pop up and run away. They run with bare feet on jagged rocks over volcanoes, and they can't be stopped. And this isn't to induce fear. This is to induce a sense of awe, right? A sense of wonder, a sense of inspiration. And so the Moros are co-opted into this narrative. The Americans want to preserve this savagery. But the problem is, violence and savagery is not conducive to colonial rule. And so the Americans have a problem. They say, how do we preserve their manliness? How do we preserve their masculinity? How do we preserve what they are? And the Americans, of course, borrowed from this greatly. I published this piece on a frontier violence and justice where the Americans were living in this frontier beyond the gaze of the modern state, the same way we kind of romanticize the West, in which they could hire Moro bounty hunters. And they have all these wild stories where they said, hey, we want you to go bring these guys in for a crime. And the Moros would show up for their bounty, and instead they were carrying a burlap sack. And the Americans said, what's this? They would dump the sack out and half a dozen heads would roll out and they would want their money, right? Or they would avenge themselves in tribal feuds and clan feuds, and the Americans just, they couldn't get enough of it. But the problem is, how do we preserve this? But at the same time, not allow it to be a threat to colonial authority. How do we preserve savagery and domesticate violence? Now, the American military in particular was thinking a lot about this. When they got to Mindanao, one of the first things they say in their commission reports is that we do not want to repeat the mistakes we made with the Native Americans. Military men really kind of lamented the fact that there was this proud and noble and very romanticized version of these savage Native Americans. But we conquered them, and now they're a conquered people, just like the Filipinos were a conquered people. The Americans also looked to the British model in Malaya, where they said maybe we could use some of these subsidiary allies, right, that we could rule through them and largely leave them alone. But that didn't sit well with them either, because they're progressives, right? They're crusaders. They want to develop modern man. And so the Americans had to find a way to preserve savagery and domesticate violence. Well, I cover this more extensively in my book, but let me tell you how they do this, at least in part, with the story of three carnivals. Now, the American military and the American regime at large had to ask themselves a question that I don't know if you've ever asked yourself. I ask my class this when I talk about Orientalism, where we have people come and we say, do a dance or do something from your culture, right? Show us your culture. And I've been a lot of places in this world, and I can honestly say I've never been asked to do anything American, right? Nobody says, hey, do something American. Why don't you whip a nene for me or something? And I've never been asked to do that, right? Because in the Orientalist gaze, the colonizer defines and the colonized is defined. But in this situation, the Americans have to reverse that gaze a little bit, and they have to say, wait, if we're going to civilize them and make them into Americans, then what are Americans? What do Americans do? And they came up with a couple of ideas. Number one, and this shouldn't come as a surprise, Americans consume. Right? That's what we do. We buy stuff. Okay? That's why we work, and that's why we get trained, and because we want to buy stuff. And so from one end of the Philippines to the next, they are plastering it with advertisements for Ivory soap and Levi jeans and Coca-Cola and consume. The second thing Americans like to do is they like their leisure time. Right? That's what we work for as well. We want to consume. We want to have leisure time. And so they created public parks. Daniel Birmingham very famously creates a number of parks across the Philippines, and they tell them have picnics and fly kites, and they create baseball rec leagues throughout the islands. And so they want them to go out and experience leisure time and consumption. And they felt that these carnivals could have all of it. I don't know if you've ever been to a county fair, but it's all there. You can consume until your heart's content. You can have all kinds of leisure time until your heart's content. But at their essence, fairs are also competitions, right? You show up, you want to bake a pie, you can submit it with other pies, and they'll taste it and tell you if it's good. If you want to raise a cow or a chicken or anything like that, you can take it and you can compete. And at the end, you get your reward. You can sell it, right? And so we have everything. It's sort of a microcosm. And so throughout the Philippines, they wanted to hold these. And so they had a couple of big ones after experimenting with them in various places. And the first one I want to talk about is the Carnival of 1908. In 1908, the Moros had already risen to the top of the American consciousness, at least in military circles and some elite circles. And so they were one of the main draws to the carnival. On the cover of the official souvenir program of the Philippine Carnival, they have plastered an image of a Moro, violent and menacing, essentially taunting the patrons, highlighting his savagery and violence. Moros at the fair were presented as savages in this grand exposition. And to bring the point home, military men ordered a mock battle between the Moros and hill tribes using their actual weapons. They also contracted with a group of Jolano Moros, which were pirates, in some extent still continue today in the form of the Abu Sayyaf group and things like this. But they actually contracted with these pirates and said, hey, we're going to set up a bunch of vessels in Manila Bay. We want you guys to attack it, loot it, and burn it. And everybody's going to watch from the shore. And this will be a grand sort of exposition of what you're all about. And so they did. The Moro pirates loaded up their vindas. They went out into Manila Bay. They set fire and looted the ships, much to the delight of the crowd. One reporter recounts, they looted it in the custom of the good old days, before the strong hand of law and order was extended over these people. Which sounds oddly nostalgic. What good old days is he talking about? Right? They've only been in the Philippines since 1899. Why is he reminiscing about the good old days? And at the same time, why is he lamenting the strong hand of law and order that's extended over these people? He's seeing not only the romantic days of the West, but he's also seeing the recapitulation of the settlement and domestication of the West, and it's causing a little bit of what we call imperial nostalgia. He's sad. He's sad to see this. Nevertheless, the savagery, the violence, is beginning to be contained in theatrical ways, which is, interestingly enough, kind of the way we experience primal violence, right? Watch a movie, and you can see in the movie, I shudder to think how many murders we've been exposed to in our lives, right? At least cinematically. But this is a way that they can preserve it. Now, this was only the beginning. They realized that they had something. And so at the Philippine Carnival of 1909, they decide that they're going to take it to the next level. Again, Moros figure prominently in the display, and the military felt that there had to be even a more enhanced emphasis on mock violence. This time, they punctuated the Moro exhibit with a grand display of all their weapons, a number of kris, which of course had their mythology of their own, that they had magic powers, that they could be made to fly through the air, that some were poisoned spiritually. They had a number of Moro cannons, ships, anything that had to do with violence. Building on the piracy and looting performance staged at the Carnival of 1908, organizers thrilled observers with a full-fledged Moro attack on the city of Manila. This time they weren't just looting ships out in the bay, they wanted them to actually lay siege to the city. At 9 o'clock in the morning, on the 28th of January, 1909, a number of Muslim pirate ships containing over 200 Moros entered Manila Bay and swiftly ascended up the Pasig River, flying battle flags. Landing below the historic Bridge of Spain, the Moro pirates disembarked and in full battle array advanced through the main thoroughfare, encountering the least resistance. Swiftly, they captured the Escolta and the Plaza Goiti. The invaders then swept across the Santa Cruz Bridge and turned their might on the carnival grounds. With a gongs and tom-toms sounding a savage beat, the brass lancas cannons blasting occasional salutes from the ships, the Muslim warriors brandished bladed weapons, spears, shields, and battle flags as they advanced on the awestruck and terrified crowds. So essentially what they're doing is they're having this invasion in which the Moros are laying siege the way they did to villages along the Mindanao and Visayan coast years before in order to specifically terrorize the patrons of the fair. Now, they orchestrated this to be as violent and as showy as possible. It was arranged, announced the Mindanao Herald, a newspaper, that the picturesque people from Moro Province made their entrance into the capital of the island as striking and as novel as possible. The entrance of our well-behaved Moro citizens into Manila and all the regalia of the ancient pirates, their forefathers, promised to afford a distinctly interesting and novel sensation to the visitors of Manila. The Moros were encouraged to display their weapons openly and to make plenty of noise, in a wartime fashion, beating and pounding drums as they pressed upon the carnival of patrons. And so you could see what the military is doing here. They want this to be as theatrical and as savage and as barbaric and as frightening as possible, but the lesson is learned because after the invasion of Manila, after they press upon the patrons, and women shriek and children turn their eyes, the Moros then shoulder their weapons, dutifully turn, and take their place at the Manila Carnival. The violence hasn't been extinguished. The violence has been domesticated. The violence has been harnessed. The violence has been controlled. Once they take their place at the exhibit, the Moros were then ordered to perform a number of native dances. And I wonder how native these dances were. They included the warrior dance, the sword dance, and the much-acclaimed pirate dance, many of which had mock executions, stabbings, and throat cuttings. The seafaring Moros also enacted executing their captives after a slave raid. They enacted capturing slaves and pressing them into service. Things that had a distinct, disturbing, and yet nostalgic tone in the minds of Americans. Things that they could see in their own past. The fact that these well-behaved Moro citizens had been domesticated but not irrevocably subjugated by American officials was noteworthy. And then the point came full circle. A day after the Moro invasion of Manila, the U.S. military performed its own theatrical performance. To enhance the point, American military assemblages laid siege to the city of tomorrow for enthusiastic crowds. Combined units of cavalry, artillery, infantry, navy, and scouts poured a steady fire on the objective from every vantage point. At the close of the fight, the city took fire. And for several minutes, those who were so fortunate to be present witnessed one of the most beautiful sights ever presented to a holiday-making throng, according to the Manila Times. And so the American military conducted their own invasion. They shot up and burned a city to the ground. Now, this thrilling and spectacular episode couldn't help but establish a significant and obvious connection among American imperialists and observers to the Muslims' similar feat 3 days earlier. Well, the American military demonstration was clearly meant to show the surpassing firepower and military technology of the American colonial state. It also illustrated an important object lesson. The Moros are not that far behind. The Moros are also prototypical Americans on the evolutionary path towards modernity. They have the grit. They have the courage. They have the masculinity. The indomitable spirit of battle demonstrated by the Moros was then shown with the full trappings of modernity by the American military only a day later. In other words, the military is bragging to the rest of the colony, we are succeeding. While you all languish with your programs of education, while you all languish with your programs of sanitation, while you all languish with your programs of implementing democracy and representative government and all these things we love so much, you're failing. We're succeeding. And we're succeeding because we have the prototypical ideal candidate for modern man. And they bring the point home finally in the Carnival of 1910. In the Carnival of 1910, there are no mock invasions, there are no pirate attacks, there are no mock executions. There's simply a company of 50 Muslim soldiers from the Moro Constabulary. These soldiers wore the usual khaki uniforms, double ammunition belts, rolled blankets, haversacks, and most importantly, rifles. There was a distinct Muslim flair to it. The men, as you can see, wore red fezes and, most importantly, had bare feet. So you can see that the military is doing the same thing here. We've modernized them, but we haven't completely extinguished the primal link to savagery. They're still barefoot, right? We're still talking about the people we're bragging about. They can run through the jungle. They can take pain. The newspaper reports, for example, the reason for the men being barefooted is easily understood. No Moro ever uses footgear. From childhood up, he runs barefooted like all savages, and the soles of his feet soon harden. Boots lame him. They make him footsore. Moreover, in marching through the dense forests of Mindanao along trails that are narrow and steep, he can get a better hold with his bare feet than he can with boots. This time in 1910, there were also demonstrations. But they were demonstrations of modern warfare using modern weapons. The barefooted Mohammedan, as they put it in the newspaper, had been fully domesticated, but not conquered. His violence had been harnessed, but used to the advantage of the colonial state and not against it. Now, there were still some trepidation. All right, there's still some trepidation. The Philippine Monthly, a Manila-based paper, wrote at the time, "The Moro, as a disciplined soldier, was untried. His loyalty, when once he had gotten a modern weapon in his hand, was a matter of grave conjecture. And his peculiarities as a Mohammedan, as well as his bellicose disposition, had both alike to be taken into consideration." The military enjoyed this as well, right? We always want to create a sense of trepidation. We always want to create a sense of distance, because without it, we have a conquered subject. And so what we see in these three carnivals is that the military successfully, at least in their own minds, creates a discursive moral identity, meaning that the Moros similarly participate. This isn't foisted upon them. It's mutually informative. Created a colonial subject that was on an ideal, rapid path to modernization. Ironically, the American military argues that colonial subjects are not to be conquered. They're to be circumscribed. They're to be preserved. They're to be trained. And to some extent, the Moros agreed. Now, all of this comes crashing down in 1914. In 1914, in the United States, the Democrats come to power. They're largely anti-imperialist. Wilson appoints a new governor general over the colony and demands a process of what is called Filipinization, where the Moros and the Highlanders are folded into the larger civilian colony. At the time, the Moros begged and pleaded. We have letters going clear up until 1942, where they're begging the United States government, let us be separate. And this conflict largely continues today with the separatist wars in the southern Philippines, where they feel that they were unfairly forced into a colony of a Christian majority where they never belonged. And so despite the colonial relationship, there still exists a certain fondness, a certain mutual respect, a certain nostalgia that you'll see in the southern Philippines with the Moros and the American military period. Ron Edgerton, for example, writes extensively on cowboy culture in the southern Philippines. It's the oddest thing. You can go to the southern Philippines, you can go to Cotabato or Lanao, and hear old 1970s and 80s outlaw country. So if you know who Waylon Jennings is, or you know Willie Nelson or Merle Haggard or any of those, they're playing them to this day in the Philippines. Many of the stores are set up with the old-style Western facades, and they actually have hitching posts out front because it is the last frontier. It was the last American frontier. All right, well, I'm going to leave it there. I wanted to leave about 25 minutes for questions. I wanted to time that. So I'm going to leave it there. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really, really interesting lecture. Since this event is taped, thanks to Mr. Bob Cote from the Omaha KIOS Public Radio. So questions, please come to the microphone so that it will get recorded. As the host of tonight, I'm going to pose you the first question. The lecture is just so well done, telling something which we do not really know much about it. Americans by teaching in this college that I realized that our students do not get much historical knowledge from their high school, unfortunately, especially on Asia and related subjects. Filipinos is a very, very unique, you know, story that the last frontier, which is very, very true. And there are so many Chinese also in the Philippines. They integrated very well with either the Muslim population or the Christian population. How does the Chinese population, who may be part of the Muslims in the south, what do you have any reflection on that part of the stories that with relation with the Chinese Muslims in the Philippine south and with the United States, the relation perspective? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, so the Chinese population in the Philippines goes back, is time immemorial, but certainly we see during the Ming Dynasty and the Song Dynasty, large trading communities in Manila. And the Americans, with regard to the Chinese, had a kind of double mind about it. On the one hand, they deeply admired the Chinese because they were so adept at trade and they were so shrewd and they were so robustly engaged in the broader market systems of Southeast Asia. At the same time, they were also a little bit wary of the Chinese for reasons they carried a lot of these prejudices from 19th century America as well, where they viewed the Chinese as clannish and somehow mystical in this orientalist kind of way. But the American military in the South actually made a concerted effort to keep Chinese out of Mindanao. And the reason they did that is because they didn't want a flood of cheap labor coming in and displacing some of the opportunities for growth and work that they hoped the Moros would take advantage of. So I didn't get to talk about it in this lecture, but the American military spends enormous amounts of money creating what are called Moro markets, where they feel that the Moros have this natural inclination towards capitalism and they're market-minded and they're entrepreneurs and so they wanted these markets to be sort of exclusively Moro, and there was a fear that if we let Chinese in or even if we let some northern Filipinos in, that these markets will be hijacked, that there's going to be a flood of cheap labor and the plantation system will establish itself and the farming of hemp and all these things. And so the American military, I don't know if they had a particular dislike for the Chinese community, but they were wary of any outsider coming in and disrupting some of their colonial policies.
Thank you, Professor, for your talk. I was curious about a couple things with American colonialism, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of our first push into colonialism after the Spanish-American War with Cuba and the Philippines. How, because you'd mentioned that after the carnivals, after 1910, things really kind of shift gears. How did the administration work with the colonies? Was it more of a military affair? Was Washington heavily involved? And I'm wondering how that kind of relates to other colonialist endeavors by the French or the British. Was there lessons learned, or what was going on, I guess, in the control factor, and how did this idea of American nostalgia kind of seep its way into what the administration wanted for the colonies?
Good. Yeah. So the broader colony was ruled in a much, much different way. The Americans immediately, they have a governor general and they have a number of colonial officials, but they immediately create a Philippine assembly. The Americans in some ways are the odd, I tell my students this, they are the oddest imperialists in the history of imperialism because they create an imperialism that is in so many ways not imperialism. So they seize the Philippines, they have this very authoritarian idea of controlling the population and modernizing the population, but at the same time, create a Philippine assembly, begin to implement democracy at the local level, empower them politically as much as possible. They allow, to a certain extent, opposition political parties. They allow, to a certain extent, opposition newspapers. As a matter of fact, very famously, Manuel Quezon, who later becomes president of the Philippines, is in Washington and he's in front of the Senate. And at one point, he pounds the pulpit and he says, "Damn you, Americans, why don't you treat us worse?" Right? Like, people are too apathetic now because you're giving all kinds of modern democratic reforms that they never had under the Spanish. And so it's blinding the people to how oppressive colonialism is, right? How this is not fostering a good, healthy, emerging nation state. Now, in the South, the military was not playing any of those games, and they were not involved in the various politicking in the United States. You know, you've got a number of different interests, both imperialists and anti-imperialists, that run the gamut, right? So you have anti-imperialists that are genuinely – believers that this is wrong. Okay, this is antithetical to what we are. American values do not say that we go overseas and acquire colonies, right? Self-determination and liberty. And Mark Twain, very famously, I think, was one of these. But then, of course, you also have anti-imperialists that have the most horrific reasons, right? I mean, there's a lot of Southern Democrats that say, we don't want imperialism because we don't want any more people of color in our polity. And so they're just straight racist. I mean, Ben Pitchfork Tillman is one of the example. Then you have pro-imperialists that also run the gamut, where you have what we might say sort of greedy corporate imperialists that say, hey, let's go loot the place and make a ton of money. But I think the vast majority, which are often the most sinister, we can have a whole debate about that, are these overwhelming humanitarian colonialists. People that I hate to criticize because I'm one of them, right? I mean, we at Creighton, we love to go do good things. We go around the world and we want to make the world a better place. But it's often the most invasive and insidious, and, you know, we could have a whole discussion about colonial medicine. You know, the colonialism suddenly gave them the right to inoculate and fumigate and sanitize, and think of the intimacy of what happens when you go to the doctor, and then imagine imposing that on someone who doesn't want it. And so it's often sort of the most sinister aspect of colonialism. Well, for the military, they felt, we don't have to deal with any of that, right? Because we're not beholden to election. I'm not going to be elected next year. I don't have to negotiate with all these constituencies. And I am expressly not charged with implementing American-style democracy down here. And so you have a governor general of the colony. There were only three of them. Leonard Wood, famously, and then Pershing, famously, were two of them. And then they had a small legislative council. And then they had tribal wards in which they would appoint what were called datus, which were chieftains among the Muslim tribes. And then they would be an intermediary, sort of a colonial representative on the ground. And so for the military, they said, this is great because we have a policy. We just go, boom. It's very concise. We can have direct contact with the people. It's not all mediated, not all negotiated. And we can really do this project correctly. And so that's what made him so excited. And the military was as opposed to Filipinization in 1914 as the Moros were. They were really disappointed. They felt, you're derailing our entire project here. And I don't want to make it sound too rainbows and flowers. I mean, there were times the Moros definitely resisted and resented American presence. There were holdouts and rebellion. I published a piece on a massacre at Badajoz where the American military sieged a volcano, an extinct volcano, where there were hundreds of men and women and children inside, and they simply pointed the weapons down and butchered them all. And so it wasn't all pleasant. I don't want to give that impression. But at the same time, it was mutually collaborative in so many ways, the colonial regime. Much more so, I'd say, than other places in the islands.
Please join me in welcome and thanks.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Michael Hawkins, Associate Professor of Asian History and Associate Chairman in the Department of History at Creighton, as well as author of Making Moros, Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in the Philippines' Muslim South. Dr. Hawkins spoke on the topic American Colonization of Muslims in the Southern Philippines. His remarks were given as the faculty lecture, part of the 11th Annual Asian Culture Week, presented by Creighton's Asian World Center. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 28, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Marang Jang, Director of the Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.